You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, could the federal government be rolling out the pork barrel again? We'll find out if congressional earmarks could make a comeback and pave the way for compromise. Now, Pfizer announced that its vaccine is safe and extremely effective for kids as young as 12. Even though severe cases of COVID are rare in children, it can still happen. And U.S. Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci has said that children will probably need to be vaccinated in order to achieve herd immunity overall. Pfizer is not the only company testing to see if its vaccine works for kids. Moderna started clinical trials of its vaccine for kids between 12 and 17 in December. And Johnson & Johnson will start working with children soon, too. We're talking about the COVID vaccine for children and how vaccinating kids could play a part in ending the pandemic. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, if the FDA approves COVID vaccines in use for kids, how you feel about that? Will you have your children vaccinated? What questions do you have for a pediatrician about the COVID vaccine and kids? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is a pediatric infectious disease physician at Mayo Clinic Children's Center. Dr. Rajapakse, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what do you make of this news? A Pfizer, this vaccine in kids from 12 to 15, looking pretty good, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is really exciting news for us as pediatricians and pediatric infectious disease specialists. What they announced yesterday is more that exceeds what we thought we would see in terms of efficacy of vaccine in kids. So yesterday, Pfizer released that the vaccine generates a really excellent, robust immune response in kids 12 to 15 years of age. And it was studied in about 2,200 adolescents. And of the adolescents who received the vaccine, none ended up developing COVID-19 infection. And so that's just really excellent news that we need at this point in the pandemic, because it gives us hope that we will hopefully have a vaccine for this age group soon, hopefully by the beginning of the next school year. And even better, when they looked at side effects, they did not see any serious side effects in that age group, and the vaccine was very well tolerated. So really exciting information released by Pfizer yesterday. There are still some more steps that they need to go through, including presenting the information to the FDA to see whether we will get emergency use authorization to expand the lower age limit down. But the initial information that we've seen looks really promising.
Yeah. What would be the timeline if they give this info to the FDA and they approve it? What would be the timeline when they could get that emergency use authorization for this younger age group?
So it's a little bit difficult to predict. Obviously, everything needs to be reviewed really closely to make sure that the vaccine is effective, the vaccine is safe before anything gets approved. And so that generally happens at least over the course of a few weeks. But we're hopeful, given these results, that things seem to be lining up for a possible vaccine to be available for this age group before the school year starts.
A question that I've seen floating around out there is, you know, given that kids of that age, they seem to be less vulnerable to the ravages of COVID-19, why would we be excited about a vaccine for this age group? What would you tell people to sell this to them?
So I think there's a few really important things to understand about COVID-19 and children. One is that we know children of all ages can be infected, and children of all ages can transmit the infection. And so certainly they could play a role in transmitting infection to others who may be at higher risk of more severe illness. Secondly, there have been children who have required hospitalization. In fact, over about 14,000 children in the United States have been hospitalized due to COVID-19. And unfortunately, we've had around 300 children who have died either of COVID-19 infection or the related multisystem inflammatory syndrome, a condition that can occur rarely in kids who have had COVID-19 previously. And so while kids have been not impacted to the extent that adults have, it certainly can cause severe illness and deaths in that age group as well. And if we have something that can prevent that, of course, we want to offer that to children as well. Lastly, in terms of bringing this pandemic to the end, the vaccine is a really important tool in our toolkit. We need to achieve this concept of herd immunity, and there's two ways to get there. One is by people having natural infection, which comes with a lot of risk and risk of hospitalization and death. And the second way is through vaccination, where you derive immunity without that risk of having serious illness or side effects. And so about 25% of the population in the United States is under 18 years of age, and it'll be really hard to achieve the herd immunity threshold, which we think is somewhere between 70 to 90% if we don't vaccinate kids under 18 years of age.
And stepping away from kids for a moment, you mentioned that natural immunity because you got the disease and took all the consequent risks versus vaccine. It seems like I'm seeing research, Dr. Rajapakse, that suggests that vaccine immunity is more effective and maybe longer lasting than the immunity you get if you have that disease. What are you seeing in the research?
Yeah, so this is a really important question that people are studying and watching very closely. Unfortunately, the infection hasn't been around for all that long, and the vaccines are relatively new in their administration. And so we need some time to determine exactly how long immunity from natural infection and vaccination last. There have been some studies that suggest that the vaccine generates higher antibody levels than natural infection in some populations. And so that is suggestive that it may provide better protection, potentially longer lasting protection than having the infection itself. But I think we still need to understand a bit more and follow people who have had natural infection and vaccine for longer to know exactly how long the protection lasts.
Talking to Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse from Mayo Clinic Children's Center, pediatric infectious disease physician there, looking at the latest vaccine news and research on COVID-19 vaccines for kids right now in the 12 to 15 age range. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Rajapakse, why do we treat kids under 16, say, differently than grown-ups when it comes to researching a vaccine and then putting out into public use?
So kids are generally considered to be a vulnerable population along with pregnant women. And so it is quite typical that when new vaccines are developed, they get studied in generally healthy adults first so that we can ensure they're efficacious and safe before we start to include some of these other more vulnerable populations. So that's exactly what was done in this situation here with the pandemic and with COVID-19. There are also other specific considerations when it comes to differences in the immune system of children and adults, which means that the studies in kids will be a bit different because we need to first identify what the optimal dosing strategy is in kids. Do they need a higher dose? Do they need a lower dose? Can they get the same dose as we're giving in adults? And once we identify what the optimal dosing strategy is, to then follow them and see how well they're protected by that dose. And so there's a lot of things that change in our immune system as we grow. The immune system of a 14-month-old child is quite different than the immune system of a 14-year-old or a 40-year-old. And so that's exactly why we need to do these clinical trials in these different age groups to verify that the vaccine is protective and safe in these populations as well.
Yeah, we started off talking about kids age 12 to 15. What's the research timeline now for younger kids under 12 down to maybe those infants? I assume that's a more delicate, sensitive research that might take longer.
Yeah, so these studies are now occurring. Just in the last couple of weeks, both Moderna and Pfizer have announced that they have started testing their vaccines in the 6 month to 12 year age groups. And they seem to be kind of progressively decreasing the age range. So mostly starting with kind of the 5 to 12 year age group and then progressively going down from there. And so these trials have just started enrolling in the last couple of weeks. And so we anticipate that there may be results by the end of 2021 and that the soonest that a vaccine may be available for some of those age groups would be in early 2022. But certainly there's a lot of things that can happen between now and then. And so those are all kind of predictions based on how it has gone with the other trials.
We're talking about COVID vaccines for kids and the overall vaccination effort. Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is with us, pediatric infectious disease physician at Mayo Clinic Children's Center. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about COVID-19 vaccines and the vaccination effort for kids or for grownups while we're at it? Do you feel safe sending your kids back to in-person school now? Would you feel safer with the COVID vaccine for kids? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with pediatrician Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse about the COVID vaccine for kids and for grown-ups. She's with Mayo, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions about the latest on vaccines, maybe your own experience getting or giving vaccines if you're out there administering them yourself. That's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Rajapakse, as you mentioned, this is, in the scope of things, a fairly new illness still. We've only had the vaccines for a while now. But what are we seeing now that we've got a lot of vaccines out there in the real world versus just in clinical trials? How effective do they seem to be at protecting people from getting the disease, or if they get it, from getting a severe version of the disease?
So currently we have three vaccines that have been authorized for emergency use, and now we have millions of people across the country who have received at least the first dose of vaccine, and many who have received two doses. And we're seeing that the vaccines, as they were shown in the clinical trials, are extraordinarily protective against severe COVID-19 disease, hospitalization, and death. Really, when you look at the rates, especially in long-term care centers, which were one of the first areas to receive vaccine and that were really struggling with their high-risk population with a lot of illness and deaths. Once vaccine was introduced into those settings, we saw a really dramatic reduction in illness and serious disease especially. So the vaccines do seem to be performing in real world settings as they performed in the clinical trials, which is significantly reducing serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. That being said, there are a few challenges ahead, and we're in a very critical time in the pandemic now, especially with the rise of these different variants. And so we need to continue to monitor how effective the vaccines are as different variants start to become more prominent circulating in our communities here. So it's something that people are keeping a very close eye on, and we'll need to kind of watch closely going forward. The other thing is the vaccines are a fantastic tool to reduce the infection in our communities, but it doesn't mean that we can shut the light switch off on all the other things we've been doing for the past year in terms of masking, hand washing, avoiding crowds, and staying home if we're feeling ill. We're really kind of in a race against these variants. And so keeping transmission down while accelerating the administration of vaccines over these next few weeks, it's really going to be critical in deciding what direction things go for us in the next few months to come.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Woodstock, Illinois. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have a 12-year-old relative who is a type 1 diabetic, and I know her family would like her to be able to be vaccinated. I was wondering if that is something, when they're looking at this younger population, are they looking at it's people like her?
Interesting. Rebecca, thanks for the call. Dr. Rajapakse.
That's a great question, Rebecca. The different trials are enrolling different children. Primarily, they're focusing on healthy children, but certainly different children with different underlying medical conditions can be at higher risk for serious COVID-19 illness and infections. And so I haven't seen the exact exclusion criteria or whether there are certain specific conditions that they are excluding, but certainly vaccination would be an important part of preventative strategy, especially for children who have other underlying conditions that may increase their risk of having severe illness.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it at 800-642-1234. I appreciate that. And you can join in with your questions and comments, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Rajapakse, as you were just mentioning, the vaccines are out, and that's great news. But we're in this race against those variants. Are you seeing COVID fatigue out there with people looking at the good news and maybe being too quick to want to give up the masks and the other precautions you were just saying we really need to still keep for now?
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing this, and I'll admit I'm feeling it a bit myself as well. I think we've all been at this for the past year. It's been really challenging to not be able to see friends and loved ones and go out and eat in restaurants and get together with people we care about. And I think we're all kind of getting to the end of our rope with all of this. But as I mentioned, especially with these variants, which certainly seem to be more transmissible, this is a really critical time, because if we play the next few weeks and months wrong, we could end up with a fourth wave here. And so we really need to accelerate vaccine administration, and so that we protect as many people in the community as possible. But until we achieve really high levels of vaccine-related immunity in our communities, we all really need to continue to adhere to the other preventative measures like masking, washing your hands, avoiding crowded places, just because at this point, even though millions of people have been vaccinated, not everyone has that full protection, and there's still risk of transmitting and spreading the infection amongst people who are non-immune, and potentially even with vaccination. One of the things is that asymptomatic or very mild infections, you may still have the ability to transmit the infection. And so that's why we're still asking everyone, even if they have had their vaccines, when they're out in public, to continue to really follow all of the advice we've all been following over the past year. And if we can do that now, I think we have a much better chance of bringing the pandemic to an end and kind of throwing the switch and opening up everything and putting all those other preventative precautions aside right now is kind of like giving up at the end of a marathon when the finish line is in sight. And so we really don't want to do that because we're very fortunate to have these vaccines. We just need time to get enough immunity in our communities so that we can slowly then start to peel back some of these restrictive things we've had to do to protect everyone over the last year.
Talking to Dr. Napuni Rajapakse, pediatric infectious disease physician at Mayo Clinic Children's Center, looking at the latest on vaccines, some of the latest research, and research looking into their effectiveness in kids, younger and younger ages. Part, our guest says, of the effort to get overall herd immunity for the population at large. Dr. Rajapakse, do we know why COVID didn't seem to hit kids as hard as grown-ups, and especially as seniors? Not all viral diseases play out that way. Do we have a sense of why that is this time around?
Yeah, so that's a really great question, Rob. There certainly are viruses that we're very familiar with. So if we think about influenza or another common virus called RSV or respiratory syncytial virus, those really tend to affect the extremes of age. So especially young children, and then the elderly seem to be the ones who get most sick with this. So back last spring, when we were just learning about this infection, our fear was that we may see a similar phenomenon with SARS coronavirus 2. And we really have not seen that as things have played out over the past year. There's a few theories about why this may be. Certain differences in how kids' immune systems fight this infection seem to help to give them some protection from having more serious illness. They seem to be able to clear the infection more easily than adults, and therefore they have a lower risk of having a severe disease. The receptor that the virus uses to get into our cells, kids seem to have a different distribution of it, such that they don't seem to have very much of that receptor down low in their lungs, which is where the virus causes a predominant disease. And so that may lend them some protective effect as well. So there's a lot of different reasons that likely play into this. I don't think it's going to be one thing. It'll probably be a combination of different factors as to why kids have fared reasonably well through this pandemic.
Well, those receptors you mentioned, we got an email from Richard who's wondering about kids and their ACE or ACE receptors. Is that the ones you happen to be talking about there?
Yeah, those are the ones. So that's the kind of lock that the virus uses to as a key to get into our cells. So that's how it enters the cells in our body.
So again, it feels like we've been living with this thing forever. It's still fairly new in the scope of human history. What kind of questions, Dr. Rajapakse, are still open and unanswered that you're looking forward to seeing answers to?
Yeah, so I'm, as a pediatric infectious disease specialist, really interested to see these results that are going to be coming out about the vaccine efficacy and safety in our pediatric age groups. Obviously, the toll has taken a toll on kids and families in kind of a different way than resulting in severe illness or hospitalization, but the impact on mental health of children has been profound, and the impacts it's had on education and physical activity and many other aspects of their daily lives has been incredible. And so we're really interested to see that these vaccines are working in them and safe so that we can get them protected and get our communities protected. I think watching to see these variants that are evolving and how that impacts transmission and rates of infection in different parts of the country will be very important in the coming weeks and months. How these impact the efficacy of our vaccines also will be an important thing to follow. And I think the questions about how long immunity lasts with the vaccines is a really important one for us to answer. That'll help us decide whether this is going to end up being a vaccine like the flu vaccine that we recommend people get every year, whether it gets rolled into our routine childhood immunization schedule, or what the best way to ensure people remain protected from this infection are. And so we really need that information in order to make some of those decisions. And so those are the things I'll be looking out for in the coming weeks and months.
Well, us too. Dr. Rajapakse, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse is a pediatric infectious disease physician at Mayo Clinic Children's Center. She joins us for a look at COVID vaccines and kids. Some new research finds at least one of the three vaccines out there looks quite safe and effective for kids 12 to 15, waiting on emergency approval from the FDA to have that actually happen out in the public. Coming up, we talk to a public policy and management expert about the history of pork, government spending earmarks, and whether it could return to help maybe pass things like, say, a new infrastructure package. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the United States has now fully vaccinated half of all seniors against COVID-19. But cases are rising. Jen White and her expert guests are back answering your vaccine questions. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now we're going to talk about pork. No, it's not Food Friday yet. Still Thursday. Tomorrow we are going to talk about Hmong cuisine, so get hungry for that. But now we're going to take a look at pork barrel spending, also known as governmentally directed spending, also known as earmarks. Where'd they come from? Where'd they go? And could they come back and make Congress more productive? Our next guest thinks there's at least a possibility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think government earmarks were a good idea? Do you want to see them come back or stay gone? Do you have a question about what they are, how they work, and how they could be made to work better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Don Kettle is the Sid Richardson Professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, where he focuses on public management and policy. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and previously taught political science at UW-Madison. Don, welcome back to the show.
Rob, it's great to be with you and always great to be back in Wisconsin.
Good to have you back. Now, start us off with a basic definition. When we say earmarks, what are we talking about?
Earmarks, and the definition is a little sloppy, but essentially means that it is a bit of legislation that earmarks or focuses in particular a bit of federal spending for a particular congressional district for a particular project. So, for example, there may be an earmark to include a new $1.3 trillion program for a, $1.3 million program for, say, a new bridge in Milwaukee or an expansion of an interstate highway going through the center of the state. Those would be earmarks, and they'd be identified specifically in the legislation as part of the process of getting it passed. So the idea is to try to use that to build political support, and they've been around for a long time.
Yeah, talk about the early days of earmarks. When did they come about in U.S. government?
There have been earmarks or pork barrel politics for as long as there has been American government. There's actually a great story from Thomas Jefferson, who condemned the fact that early Congresses were putting the kind of extra spending into pieces of legislation, and he criticized it for talking about the spending of money on post roads, including roads to deliver the mail, as he called a bottomless abyss of public money. And Andrew Jackson battled against them as well, but we've never succeeded in getting rid of them, and it's one of those things where some people are beginning to wonder whether or not we should.
Well, and we did sort of get rid of them, right? A Republican majority in Congress put an end to the practice, or at least a version of the practice. Why did it sort of go away?
And it's sort of gone away because back in 2010, the House Republicans, who were in control at that point, argued that this was a monumental waste of government money, and that, in fact, we were maybe spending as much as $16 billion a year simply on earmarks that would run into the thousands in number. And so they created a rule that said that we were not going to be doing this any longer, that Congress was not going to be including these earmarks. Of course, that hasn't made them go away completely. It's shut them down largely, but not completely. There are pieces of legislation that creep through, and there are bits that are attached to that. The annual defense authorization bill contains lots of different kinds of earmarks for different kinds of programs. And what's about to happen in the debate over the president's infrastructure plan is going to be seeing lots and lots of these things, with everything from, say, a $10 billion tunnel project in New York City or a several billion-dollar project out in the middle of Ohio, all in an effort to try to win the votes that it will take to be able to get the program passed.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas at Austin, looking at earmarks, a.k.a. pork barrel spending. If you don't like it, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like the idea that we should get rid of some or all of these designated spending lines in government, federal government budgets? Do you think they lead to, in effect, a kind of corruption? Or would you welcome seeing them back? Do you think they could help generate some form of congressional compromise? And let's get to that issue, Don. You write about this in Governing Magazine, a piece that I think just hit the presses, well, the web presses today. How could bringing back earmarks more fully help with overcome this resistance to compromise in Congress?
One of the big problems that we've got is that the polarization on Capitol Hill has made it hard to get almost anything passed. And so at least half seriously, I make the argument that maybe we'd be a whole lot better off if we brought the pork back, if we brought back pork barrel politics and earmarks, because we could at least find ways of making the deals that are going to get things done. And if, as long as we made them transparent, we'd be essentially institutionalizing something that's going to happen anyway. In particular, for this infrastructure plan, which is still bouncing around, it's going to be somewhere well north of $2 trillion in what the administration wants to get through. If you're a fan of that program, the Democrats can afford to lose only 3 votes in the House, just 3, and no votes at all in the Senate. So the question is going to be, what's going to keep the bare majorities together to be able to pass this legislation? And the answer undoubtedly is going to be earmarks for particular projects in particular districts. If there's a senator or a member of the House on the fence, what is it going to take to be able to get them to sign on board? The other thing, too, is that bridges, highways, roads, tunnels are projects that every member of Congress, every senator, every member of the House has in their own districts as well. And so a possible way of trying to find ways of building a majority that doesn't require a single party to stand together, but maybe perhaps creates an opportunity for more bipartisan action, could be greased a bit by these earmarks. Is it going to cost some money? it's going to cost billions. But when we're talking about projects and programs that can cost in the trillions, it may be a small price to pay for actually getting things done.
I want to talk about this kind of in practice. So, you know, if I'm trying to get a bill passed, maybe I'm in a party with a narrow majority, and I go to somebody else in the other party and say, hey, I want you to vote with us. I know it might tick off your colleagues on your side of the aisle. Some of your core supporters in your district might not go along with it. But under the current system, in exchange, I can offer you absolutely nothing. I have no, there's no incentive I can offer you to take those risks. Do you think that that bringing back earmarks can overcome that that lack of incentive?
Well, I think so. If you think about this, there are two different ways at this point of getting things passed. One is the kind of threat that goes on where Republicans say, if you vote with the Democrats, we'll cut you off. And on top of that, we'll raise money to get a primary challenger against you. And somebody who has to go back to the district to run is going to be in a tough situation. Or alternatively, you can imagine a member of Congress who says that, you know, I don't really need your opposition. I can try to deal with that and win with support because I'm bringing back this new project that people in my district have been waiting for the last 5 years. And I'm going to be out there with a ribbon cutting and tell everybody that I'm the one who's bringing value back to all of you taxpayers. And so it provides a way of creating the opportunities for majority that are something other than the heavy hand of the majority leader who can sit there and engage in the kind of threats that we've seen lately. And we've seen it on both sides by Democrats and Republicans. So there's reason for hoping that we might be able to find a way to use that to find ways of getting things passed that otherwise might just end up sitting on the shelf and perhaps make Congress functional again.
On the other hand, I mean, there is the concern and the reason that people made fun of these things and mocked them and got rid of them in large part, it feels a little corrupt-ish. You know, it's not like straight up corruption where you're bribing somebody, but you are kind of buying their vote. Is it worth holding our nose a little bit and knowing that, yeah, some of that's going to happen?
First, it's going to happen anyway. Second, in a lot of ways, we as taxpayers expect it to happen. I mean, nobody sends a member of Congress to Washington with the hope that what they're going to do is make sure that all the money that gets spent in somebody else's congressional district. All of us expect that a member of Congress is going to be looking out for us and our interests. And it happens not only just, of course, on roads and bridges and other projects like that, although they are the most famous examples. But think about whatever it is that you care about. If you elect somebody to go to Congress who is going to be working on issues ranging from women's rights to foreign aid to issues in foreign policy, you would expect there to be horse trading to be able to get anything passed. And so we're always dealing with, I'll give you a little bit of that in exchange for a little bit of this. And so the question is, what's it going to take to get Congress functional again? So it does have this kind of stink of corruption sometimes about it when viewed from the outside, but it never looks very corrupt when it's the road that you've been waiting for a long time that saves you 20 minutes on your road into work or that bridge that otherwise would be falling apart that allows you to be able to take your kids to school. So when that happens, that sure doesn't seem very much like corruption to the people who benefit from it.
We're talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas Austin about earmarks for infrastructure projects or other projects and how they can maybe help solve gridlock in Congress, maybe along the lines of this new infrastructure proposal. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how pork was used in the past, how earmarks were used in the past, how they could help now? Do you think that, you know, it is inherently corrupt? Let's this idea, okay, hey, you, if you vote for this infrastructure project, we'll give you a little something. We'll make sure we've got money designated for your bridge or museum or whatever it might be. Is that okay? Do you think it's an all right way to run Congress? Do you think it might make Congress work better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about earmarks with Professor Don Kettle from the University of Texas, Austin. He says maybe bringing earmarks back, these specially designated funding lines to make sure some of the funding goes into particular congressional districts could maybe make Congress work a little better, overcome some polarization and gridlock. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. I've been wondering about this a lot. Have you? Is it on your mind? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Don, in that piece in Governing Magazine that you wrote that I mentioned, you point out that lack of gridlock or lack of earmarks isn't the only thing leading to polarization in Congress. What are some of the other things driving that, do you think?
A lot of this has to do, of course, with the role of the media. Republicans tend to listen to Republican outlets and Democrats to Democratic outlets. Rarely does everybody get their news from the same sources. So we have that for sure. We have the rise of special and single interest politics as well, where there are coalitions that gather around particular issues, whether it might be immigration on the one side or a Green New Deal on the other. And so it's become almost an article of faith that you have to oppose one or support the other. So that's another big piece. And then, of course, is the growing power of some of the party leaders in being able to engage in the kind of threats that or support that comes along with their role in Congress, being able to support people for reelection or to organize opposition if it turns out that it looks like they may be getting weak in the knees about supporting the party line. So we have that. And then add one other thing, the fact that the country is just so evenly divided. We rarely have an election where the winner and the loser are separated by more than a few percent of the popular vote. And so it makes it that much easier to make every issue an Armageddon-like issue, because any issue might have the risk of being able to tilt the race in another direction. So we've seen all kinds of things like that. There are lots of other things going on. But the real question is, what can we try to do to make Congress in particular functional again?
Yeah, I think about that. You know, here in Wisconsin, we have those tight statewide elections, so many elections for president and governor and some other offices within a percentage point in the vote. And you could say, okay, politicians would look at that and say, wow, you know, half of people support me, half of people support the other side. We should come together in the middle and find ways to make everybody a little bit happy. You know, a lot of evidence that that isn't what's happening. What would it take to incentivize that kind of thinking?
Well, and again, I think the idea of bringing back the pork, even so it may seem like a sort of a squirrely idea, it's worth thinking about, because if we think about the one thing that we know doesn't work, which is to try to make an appeal to everyone's better nature and say, okay, let's just come together in the middle, split the difference, and we'll all be happier. That's increasingly hard for anybody to be convinced to do. It's just not a strategy that works. But on the other hand, it is the case that legislators and members of Congress go to the Capitol in an interest to try to not only advocate for and pass good policy, but also they have a political incentive and a responsibility to try to do the best they can for their constituents back home. And so often doing that has to do with dealing with the things that people really care about. People hate having their tires get flat in potholes. They hate having to drive the long way around a bridge that's broken down. They hate having roads that are in disrepair. They hate having mass transit systems that don't work well. And so the idea of, you know, we could build a broader coalition. If you get a little bit of something that is really important to you and to your constituents, and we use that as a way to try to build coalitions. And there was a lot of that back in the good old days. And it's from Jefferson's days, as I pointed out, the kind of thing that's attracted a lot of political opposition. But it also provides sometimes some of the grease for the wheels that makes politics work.
Weird from Kathy in Rhinelander, who says, I feel like politicians represent their parties and their donors much more than their constituents now. And Kathy goes on, it makes them unresponsive to everyday people and slows up government. What do you think, Don?
Yeah, I think there is something to that, that the idea that people have to march in line, Republicans say behind Fox and Democrats behind CNN, and that you have this kind of party orthodoxy, it, I think, disconnects people from the actual needs of individual citizens. And one of the advantages of good old pork barrel politics and earmarks is that a member of Congress, if he or she has the power to be able to make decisions and to be able to make bargains that, in fact, benefit people back home, there's going to be a lot more pressure, a lot more incentive for doing just that. And it's going to force individual members of Congress and state legislators, I think, to pay much more attention to the needs of their constituency. You can't take broad principled positions or ideological lines and ignore your constituents if it turns out that wait a minute, over there in that next state, they got this new highway. They got the new bridge. They're getting jobs that we're not getting. Maybe we got to get somebody in there the next time who can manage to do that for us.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas Austin about the idea of bringing back earmarks, often mocked as pork barrel spending back in the day, off the table in some ways lately, but it might make a comeback. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Don, I've seen some comments, and I think this includes Maine Senator Republican Susan Collins saying, okay, maybe if we do this, we can bring it back, but do it in a more ethical way. I've seen some people say, okay, make sure that the member of Congress who inserted this thing, their name's on it, so it doesn't feel like a sneaky backroom deal. Is there a cleaner way to do this that might take some of the, I don't know, bad taste out of people's mouths about earmarks?
Yeah, I think there are two things. One is, in fact, it's transparency in two respects. The first respect would be, in fact, to identify the name of the person who's responsible for it. Although, if it turns out that it is, say, a highway in a particular district in central Pennsylvania, everybody always knew that it was Bud Schuster from the Altoona area who is responsible for that. So it's that's
pretty
clear.
Wasn't it actually named after him? I mean, that was kind of a giveaway.
There's a Bud Schuster highway. So it became clear after the fact that it was pretty obvious who was responsible for that. So the people rarely make big bargains for somebody else's district. So it's possible to be able to tell that. And the other thing is to be transparent about the amount of money that's involved. So at least we know that if there is a highway and it's a $1.5 million plan, that we know who's responsible and how much money it's costing. So transparency, I think, is the great sanitizer in all these issues. And if it's clear what the bargains are and what things are going to be, why they're being made, then it becomes a lot easier to understand and to remove the sense that there's some kind of under-the-table bargaining going on. Because one thing we want to be careful about is that there may be, for example, a contractor who stands to benefit from a new project and slides a little bit of campaign contribution in return for a member of Congress's support for a new project. And that's the kind of thing that we want to be careful about. But transparency and disclosure is the way to try to avoid that kind of problem, I think.
Let's bring on a caller now. Don is with us in La Crosse. Don, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Don?
Hello, I think that earmarks is one leg of the problem. I think the second leg of that problem is the fairness doctrine. When they let Fox and MSNBC broadcast without any contradiction. And the second leg is the Hatch Act, where they decided you don't pass anything unless you pass it in your caucus. It wasn't the Hatch Act. It was Hastert.
Hastert rule. Don, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, other Don? Don Kettle.
I always have to express appreciation to a Don, because we've got to stick together. But I think that there's something to that. There's a whole combination of things. The fairness doctrine, I think, is something that has faded away as people have paid more and more attention to the kinds of media outlets that support and reinforce their own views. And that's getting harder to try to deal with. But there's no getting away from the fact that Congress in particular has a whole series of rules that are making it harder to try to get things done. They're designed especially to try to reinforce the power of the leaders, Democrats and Republicans alike. Mitch McConnell has said that if the Democrats were to try to remove the filibuster, for example, he will use a whole collection of powers and strategies that will just simply curl their hair and turn Congress into an ash heap. It's possible to do that because of the power of leaders. And while it's unquestionably the case that we need strong leaders, what we've got is a point where the individual members have lost some of their power and their ability to be able in the process to connect with their individual constituents back home. And that, I think, is a growing problem. It's the sense that people either are in business for themselves or certainly not in business for them back home. And that's something we need to restore.
And briefly, Don, I think members of Congress, there's a lot of frustration in the public over polarization and gridlock, but a lot of pressure from part of the public to not compromise with the other side. Is that the same public?
Yeah, it's the same public. And one of the things is, it's part of the old story that, boy, we hate Congress as a whole, but we tend to love our own individual member. And we have a really difficult time in trying to find ways of making those kind of connections. The public, we're not a very easy people to govern. And we have lots of internal divisions that make it hard to develop the kind of compromises that are necessary. But compromise is necessary. There's no getting around the fact that it's impossible for any side to be able to get all of what it is that it wants. So the question is, how can we get to yes on the things that matter? What can we do to try to make sure that we can connect members of Congress and members of state legislatures back to their individual constituents? And I think it's worth at least understanding that that's the basic problem that we need to solve, and the possibility that we can at least consider the possibility that these earmarks might provide a mechanism for making that happen.
Don, thanks again for joining us today.
So it's good to be with you, Rob, and with all my friends in Wisconsin.
That's Don Kettle, Sid Richardson, professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Back in the day, formerly with UW-Madison, we talked about some of the past, present, and future of congressionally directed spending, or earmarks. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7:30, get a preview of some of the top Oscar contenders in the movie world and join in with your favorites. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Next, it's news. Then, a new survey shows that for the first time, less than half of Americans say they belong to a place of worship. We'll look at what's driving that decline and what it all means coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.